Let's generate our motivation. It's fairly easy to recognize anger when it impinges on our mind, or jealousy, because they're both quite painful. It's more difficult to recognize attachment, because attachment sometimes feels good or fills us with the thrill of expecting something wonderful in the future. And it's even more difficult to detect when ignorance or bewilderment is active in our mind. There's various levels of ignorance. Of course, the ignorance grasping at true existence is the most difficult to detect. And then there's the ignorance that doesn't understand cause and effect, that doesn't really believe in karma, and so acts in any which way. So we may sometimes espouse karma, but not really live our life as if we believed in it. And then there's some other very gross levels of ignorance. For example, distraction, where we keep our mind busy with irrelevant things. Or spacing out, having no mindfulness of what's going on in our mind, and becoming quite forgetful and even reckless. So even on a very gross level, and in our daily lives, we can see how these forms of ignorance disturb us and disturb others. Especially if we're inclined to spacing out or to distracting ourselves. Since this wastes a lot of our precious human life, it's good to generate mindfulness to bring our mind back to the task at hand. Because if we're without awareness of what's going on in our body, speech, and mind, just as we move throughout the day, we're very forgetful and spaced out. This is going to have a dramatic effect on our ethical discipline. It's going to make concentration virtually impossible, and thus it will be hard to generate wisdom. Whereas if we train our mind to focus at the task at hand, to remember, it will help us greatly in our meditation practice as well. And so specifically remembering our precepts, remembering rules of etiquette, and so on, help us in our practice of ethical discipline, that helps in concentration, that helps in wisdom, and of course doing this with the bodhicitta motivation for the benefit of all beings, to lead them to enlightenment. So I think it's good for us to be attentive to this whole thing of how we space out. Because it does consume quite a bit of time in our life. We just sit there, we go from one place to the next, and if somebody says, "What were you thinking?" we couldn't tell them. We might even sit on our meditation cushion, spend a lot of time on our cushion, but we're totally spaced out, you know, not using the time in a beneficial way, just kind of looking around at things, you know, kind of not thinking anything in particular, looking around. Or, you know, another kind of spaced out is where our mind's just full of distraction, full of, you know, I want to do this, and I want to do that, and what does this one think of me, and what does that one think of me, and I don't like this, and I don't like that, and I prefer this, and I prefer that, blah, 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 blah. You know, and we can spend a lot of time, you know, on the meditation cushion doing all of this. And I don't think that's productive time, you know. I think if we're doing a lot of that on the cushion, it can sometimes be better to be doing prostrations or be doing mandala offerings, do something physical where you have to pay attention to at least what your body is doing so that that helps your mind focus, you know, or do water bowls. I think all these preliminary practices, you know, that involve a lot of physical things, they're training us to pay attention to, you know, what our body is doing. And so that, you know, if you're spacing out and doing the water bowls, you're going to have a mess all over the table. You know, if you're spacing out doing prostrations, you're going to forget what Buddha you're on. You know? So I think that's something that's quite important. We can also see the disadvantages of being spaced out and distracted just in the harmony of community life, because when people are counting on us to do things and then we don't do it because we're spaced out and we forgot, or we were distracted and we were paying attention to small things, then, you know, it makes it inconvenient for other people in the community, and then tensions can easily arise. So, you know, as a practice of compassion, I think it's also good just to try and monitor our mind, and if we're spacing out, to, you know, kind of see what's feeding the spacing out of this. Yeah, because sometimes, you know, there's some subtle kind of thought going on that maybe we need to look at. That's if we're just doing the spaced out when we're not thinking of anything. You know, sometimes, it can be a way of we don't want to do something, so we space out and don't do it. And then, of course, we wonder why people get upset with us. So instead of being aware in our own mind of what's going on and what's feeding it, we just kind of, I forgot, get around to it later, maybe next year. You know, you know how we are. Okay, so, you know, to try and pay attention to this, because it definitely affects our human relationships and, you know, affects the community, and it certainly affects the karma that we create and the habits we get ourselves into, because we're very much creatures of habit, and if we set up this habit of spacing out, we're going to go through our whole life spaced out. And it's going to have a lot of repercussions for us. If we get in this habit of, you know, being quite distracted, then it just becomes a habit and goes on, even though we're trying to meditate, just the mind's totally distracted. So I'm not talking here about squeezing ourselves. I've got to concentrate, you know, not like that. Okay. But just pay attention, and it's often very interesting to ask ourselves, what's feeding this, you know. Especially if you have this tendency just towards total, you know. Duh. You know, what's going on there? What's going on? Okay. But I really come to see that, you know, a lot of just how we move in the world and how we move in our Dharma practice, these things are very related. And I mean, yeah, they are very related. You know, many of the skills that you find in one, you find in the other. I mean, things like intelligence aren't necessarily overlapping. Because somebody can be very intelligent in a worldly way, but completely dumb in a Dharma way. You know, with too much defilement on their mind, too much negative karma. So they can excel in school, but, you know, not get it because of the Dharma, because they lack merit, too much negative karma. But then just a lot of the skills and habits and ways of being in the world, you know, comes into our Dharma practice. Some of you have heard me mention that when I first lived in one of the Chinese temples, there was one young nun who, her room was totally immaculate. Yeah, I mean, spotless. And you had this image of, wow, you know, here, and very simple, like nothing on outside and everything. And one day I had to borrow something from her, and she opened her cupboard, totally filled with stuff. You know? Jammed with stuff. I thought, oh, that's a very interesting analogy for a state of mind, isn't it? You know? Where outside you present yourself one way, and inside there's chaos that you're not paying any attention to and not cleaning up. And it's, you know. And then other people, it's like their rooms are chaos. And so to me, you know, if somebody's, well, I make an exception for my desk. Because when I cleaned my desk up, I couldn't find anything. You know, I have to leave it on the desk to know I have to work on it. But that's my excuse. But, you know, sometimes if a workplace is a total mess or somebody's room is a mess, it's saying something about that person's mind as well. You know, I walked into my niece's room one time, all the clothes all over the floor, you know. What that said to me is like somebody who doesn't realize the fortune that she has in life, doesn't take care of the possessions she has, doesn't realize there's people in the rest of the world who doesn't have them, and doesn't care how it looks to other people and if other people have to pick up after her. You know? I mean, just, it indicates something about the state of our mind. And so I think often when we want to deal with our mind, we also have to work with just the regular worldly skills and worldly things that we do and get them cleared up. I know when I first came back, when I came back from my first Dharma course, I just cleaned out the entire house, you know, and got rid of stuff. It was like there was this incredible urge inside of me, like, get rid of stuff. You know? And looking back, it was like, oh, this was definitely related to the change that had happened because of the Dharma. Yeah. So all these kinds of things, and you know, like, you know, just fulfilling whatever responsibilities we have as we're working together, it's a sign of how much we care about other people. You know, because we don't do what people are expecting us to do. It's, you know, something's happening at some level, you know, and can't say exactly what the motivation is, but something's going on, and so it's something for, you know, to look at inside and see, because, you know, then we're going to be doing that in our Dharma practice as well. So just, you know, it's interesting, be aware of how the outside and inside fit together, external habits, internal habits. How we treat other people, how we treat ourselves, you know, like this whole thing of judgment, We're very judgmental with ourselves. We're certainly judgmental with others. We're very judgmental of others. Sometimes it's easier to notice, and then only later we notice we're judgmental of ourselves. Yeah. Kind of like first you notice your room is a mess, and then you go, oh, well, maybe my mind is too. Yeah. Okay, anyway, just something to think about. Okay, so I thought I'd talk a little bit more about the history and the development of the Sangha and, the history of Buddhism. Maybe a little bit how the Sangha community was organized. As we spoke yesterday about how it was just this loose band of wanderers, and that slowly, after 12 years, you got certain precepts being made. Then, came the recitation of the Pratimoksha. This is actually interesting because initially the recitation of the Pratimoksha was more like a statement of faith by the involved members of the Buddha's followers. Only later did it become a recitation of the precepts. Yeah. And initially, when it was the recitation of the precepts, it wasn't just reciting them. There was an actual confession going on there where people, would identify what they had done and would confess it to the community, and proper disciplinary measures would be taken. Later on, that got changed, and it was only the people who were pure in conduct could go to the confession, which meant that you had to confess at least the individual ones to somebody privately before you could go and listen. Nowadays, it's gotten changed even more, and at least in the Tibetan tradition, I think the Thais are much stricter about this, but in the Tibetan tradition, people very seldom go to anybody and confess before you do the recitation, and they do this blanket confession at the recitation. So nobody really owns what they've done, but everybody just confesses to everything and then states their purity so that you can be present. I think, it's much more helpful when we're actually able to spend some time and reflect on our precepts and do some individual confession, and, helpful when we're able to go to other people. Who was it who had their uncle who was in the confession? Yes. Yeah. So we won't go to Kathleen's uncle. Yeah. And, and it's quite different than confession in the Catholic tradition, actually, because it's more of a thing of just being able to own what we've done. And sometimes it's quite liberating to be able to state it to somebody else. I mean, even in our group discussions, you can see, a lot of that is quite freeing because we just say it and then we're over it. Whereas when we hide a lot of stuff, it takes quite a bit of energy to hide stuff. Especially when you're living in community, most people know that it's going on anyway. So it just helps to kind of clear things up, and I think it makes us more transparent, and I think in the end what it may do is make us less attached to reputation and more trusting of others. Because what is the reason why we don't like to admit our faults to others? We're afraid they're going to judge us. Why are we afraid that they're going to judge us? Because we're already judging ourselves. Yeah, and because we, so I think sometimes if we gave other people a break and recognize that they have some kindness and compassion, and they're not going to judge us. And that most of these things are actually no big deal. Of course, if you go and tell the community you stole a pencil and they all faint out of horror, then maybe it's a big deal. But I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. Okay, so that's kind of how the evolution of the body. And actually, at the beginning, that was just more of a state of faith that happened. And then it was because the wanderers of other sects used to do the you know, on the new and full moon, some kind of gathering. But then people said, well, how come the Buddhist Sangha isn't doing it? So then they started to do it. And then when they had the precepts to recite, you know, they started reciting the precepts. So that's really carried on, you know, to present day, you know, full and new moon recitations and gatherings. And in Asia, those are often days when the lay people come to the temple and they'll take the eight precepts and, you know, there'll be Dharma talks and stuff like that. Okay, some of the other regular Sangha activities, you know, posada, then of course ordination. And so here maybe it's good to sketch out the levels of Pratimoksha ordination. I think I've gone through this a few days ago, the eight types of vows. So you could have the Upasaka, Upasika, male and female lay precepts, so that's the five precepts. Then you have the Shramanera, Shramanerika, male and female novice ordination. There's the Shiksamana, which is the intermediate ordination for nuns that they keep for 2 years. Then there's the Bhikshu and Bhikshuni ordination, and the full ordination. Okay, and then there's the eight precepts, the one-day vows, and that's slightly different than the Mahayana precepts. So the Mahayana precepts, they're doing with a different motivation. So like fully ordained people are not allowed to take just the eight precepts. You know, when you're fully ordained, you're not allowed to take a lower ordination because, you know, you're already keeping those. But you can take the Mahayana precepts because that's done with a Mahayana motivation. Okay. So for the giving of the lay precepts, you can take them from somebody who has them already. It's usually a monastic. For the Shramanera and Shramanerika vows, usually that's done, you know, in front of a complement of the Sangha. Although I think I want to do some research. It may be possible to do with only two people, maybe just the preceptor and then the timekeeper. I'm not sure. Need to check on that, but I remember hearing something like that. And then the full ordination in central countries where the Sangha is very widespread, you need at least 10 people to give the full ordination. And in a country where it's not central, then at least 5 people. For some reason, the Tibetans do 4. I don't understand why. And for the nuns' vows, the best way is if there's, you know, the Bhikshuni and the Bhikshu Sangha that both give it. Pardon me? Shiksamana, that's just given by the nuns. And actually, you know, with the Shramanera and Shramanerika, for the men it should be given by the Bhikshus. For the women it should be given by the Bhikshunis. In the Tibetan tradition, because they didn't have Bhikshunis, and the Bhikshus gave that. Yeah. But hopefully it will change.
Number for the full ordination between the Dharmaguru and the Lord,
yeah.
12, is that done?
Oh, for the Shiksamana? Yeah, for the Shiksamana, for the full ordination, the Mula Shavasavada has 364, and the
no, Dharma... No, the number of ordinations. I thought there was one with 10 and one with 12.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that difference. Which is which? Let me think. I think it's 12. I think it's 12 in the Mula Shavasavada.
Okay.
I think one of them is... Yeah.
Ten,
I think. I can check on that. Remind me. They usually try to have even more, you know, when they do it. Yeah. The more the merrier. And because when you're ordained, you are getting admitted into a community. Okay? So it's what happens is that your teacher or your tutor or somebody presents you to the entire Sangha community, and then, you know, the Sangha community checks to see if you're free from certain hindrances, and if you are, then, you know, they approve of you joining the community. So it's not just something that you do with your abbot, you know, the one person who is in charge of the precepts, but it's definitely a membership into a community and the responsibility to a community afterwards. And so that's why, you know, some of the more severe vows are, you know, the disciplinary action is taken in the presence of the whole community. Yeah, because remember, Sangha means community. Yeah, with no offense, get rid of it, refers just to community or assembly of people. Yeah, most people don't realize that. They think, oh, it's just a relationship between me and my teacher, but it's not. It's membership into an entire community. And the way that community was set up is the people who made the decisions were the fully ordained people. You know, the Bhikshu and Bhikshuni communities were separate, but, you know, and each one ran their own internal affairs, but it was the fully ordained people who made the decisions. So there might be novices living there, but the novices, you know, and they may give feedback or whatever, but they weren't involved in the decision-making process. And the decision-making process was one of consensus. So, you know, you really needed to sit and talk about it. I think consensus back then is maybe different than consensus now, because now, I mean, you can be one person and call everything to a complete halt if you rely on consensus. And in our American individualistic culture, sometimes, you know, we exercise that power. I think the way it was previously was if you could live with something, you consented to it. You know, it wasn't like if that was your preference and if that was the way you thought things absolutely should be done, and, you know. But it was if you can live with it, you consented. If you thought it was really the wrong decision and you really felt you couldn't live with it, then you dissented. Okay? So that's not, you know, as voters, we always want to vote for what we think is the best one. And so then we go into consensus and it's like, well, we think like a voter, and it's like, okay, I'm going to stop the whole thing by not agreeing. You know, when actually it is something that we could live with very well. We just, you know, want our way about something. So, you know, it's a interesting process here. And the way that you expressed your consent was by keeping silent. So it's different than in the voting community where you say something. So there's this thing called Sangha karma. You know, it means an action of the Sangha. So the Sangha is referring to the fully ordained people. Before I get into that, another point that's important. You take the novice ordination for the purpose of going on to, hopefully for the purpose of going on to become fully ordained. Okay? So a novice should be training in almost all of the same vows that the fully ordained people have. You know, 17 and a half, and, you know, you don't have to do. But, you know, the idea is that you don't say, oh, well, fully ordained people have to do that. I don't have that vow, so I can go off and, you know, be however naughty I want. Well, no. Okay, it's just that you only have 10 precepts. You know, that's the Shramanerika ordination. The Tibetans divide those 10 into 36. I don't think the other traditions do. I've always been curious about the history of that division, how that arose. You know, so it isn't just that you keep those. I mean, you experience a fault if you break those. The other ones, you're trying to practice, so if you blow it, it's not quite as heavy because you don't have those precepts. So that's why the time of Shramanera ordination is a period of training. And then, you know, after you take the full ordination, then you're still supposed to be with your preceptor, or with your teacher, for a period of years to continue training until you're stable. Okay? And then when you're fully ordained for 10 years, that's when you kind of are a grown-up Sangha, and when you're expected to, you know, kind of know enough and be able to behave properly. Okay. So the Sangha karmas were held by the fully ordained people. Okay, and, you know, when the Buddha passed away, he didn't designate anybody to be in charge of the Sangha. He didn't say, I pass it on to, you know, my son or my this one or that one. You know, it wasn't Shariputra, it wasn't his son Rahula, it wasn't Mogliana. You know, it was, he said, the Dharma and Vinaya are your refuge when I'm gone. And he really stipulated that it's the Vinaya that holds the community together, not just, you know, kind of obeying one person. So I think it would be a very interesting study if somebody ever wanted to do a PhD on how, you know, the whole thing changed after that, and you began to have abbots and abbesses in charge of the community, you know? Because my guess is that that's a very culturally specific thing, because some cultures, you know, are, you know, people function much better with one person in charge, and they find it just easier. You know, that doesn't mean that kind of everybody at the time of the Buddha was absolutely equal, because certainly certain people had certain talents and more wisdom than others, and so I'm sure they kind of naturally came to the front as leaders and as guiders, and that their opinions were heeded more. And there certainly were positions even at the time of Buddha. You know, there was a manager of the Arama. There were 6 different positions, managerial positions, or, you know, storekeepers versus people who watched over the property. There were all these different positions and functions that they had to keep the community running. You had your job, you know. That was it. So, you know, according to skill and so on. What's interesting is in the Chinese community now, when you first ordain, some of the jobs, everybody is rotated through, so you learn how to do all of them. So everybody spends some time in the kitchen knowing how to cook for an entire community. Everybody spends some time in the meditation hall learning how to do all the things in the meditation hall. Everybody spends some time working in, you know, whatever projects, you know, they have. And I think that's a very interesting way of training people, because it enriches your number of skills, so then you don't wind up like somebody like me who doesn't know how to do anything with a hammer, because you actually learn, you know, through doing it. And I think also, then it helps you understand better the people who are doing those jobs, even when you're not. And so instead of getting angry at them, you know, why is this like this? Why is this like that? Well, you've worked doing that same job, and you know how tough it can be sometimes. And so it can help you to be more patient. I think that's quite interesting where they rotate. And these are some of the general functioning jobs. Of course, you know, the bookkeeper for the monastery, you're not going to rotate everybody through that, because you don't want somebody who doesn't have any skill keeping your books. It can be a royal mess. Yeah. So, you know, some of the more technical positions, you know, are more specialized according to the people. I always tell people who are junior, just enjoy your time in the kitchen. Enjoy the time that you're hammering and you're sweeping and you're pulling weeds. And enjoy the menial work, because when you get to be a senior, then you're going to have the big jobs, and the big jobs are much tougher. Yeah. And it's so interesting to me when people, you know, new people come out, I don't want to work in the kitchen. I want to do this. I want to meditate. I want to mow, you know. And, you know, they aren't aware that, like I was saying before, that when you ordain, you join a community and you have responsibility to the community. And you're training as a whole human being. You're not just learning meditation skills. You know, you're training to become, you know, this whole thing about stop being a jerk. It's like in all aspects of our life, we're training. Okay? And so some of those jobs that initially we might feel are beneath us, actually they are the most pleasurable ones to do. Okay? When you have positions of responsibility in the monastery, then as Kathleen was saying, you know, when you're the leader, the first, you know, part of the job description is you get blamed for everything and everybody plays out their authority issues with you. You know, it's no fun. So, you know, and so similarly, you know, whatever kind of you know, are the major positions in the community, those people who have more responsibility, those are the people who everybody complains about and blames and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so hopefully, because they're elder in the Dharma and they've done more training, you know, at the easy times when you can do the easy tasks, then by the time they take on the positions of responsibility, you become a little bit more, as Shantideva puts it, like a log, you know, when other people criticize you and blame you. When Shantideva talks about being like a log, he doesn't mean that you just become emotionally like, you know, solid or something like that, or discount everybody. It just means, you know, a log gets stepped on and the log doesn't do a big trip and, you know, doesn't, you know, log, you know, step on me, big deal, it doesn't matter, you know. So it's that's what he's getting at, you know, and be like a log. It doesn't mean become emotionally cold or stuff it down or stuff like that, but just, okay, somebody's blaming me again, well, yeah. What else is new today? Who's going to come from blame next? Yeah. I'm getting off on a tangent, but this is a story that I want to tell you, not just so that you have compassion for me, but in case some of you one day are in this position, you know, maybe you'll remember this story, it'll help you. But I was once kind of director of Dorje Thoma Monastery. Of course, all the nuns were, you know, complaining about me. I did this, I did that. I mean, can you imagine little old, simple, benevolent me, who's always does things the most perfect way? You know, I don't have any idea why people complain about me. But I went to Rinpoche, you know, once he was visiting. I said, Rinpoche, all these people are complaining about me. I expected him to go, yeah, I know, they're all coming and telling me about it. But he didn't say that. You know, he was very compassionate. He said, do they understand what you're doing? Yeah. It made me stop and think, no, they didn't understand what I was doing because they didn't have that responsibility and they didn't have the overview of the whole thing, you know? She said, yeah. He asked question, do they understand what you're doing? No. Well, so if they don't understand, clearly they're going to criticize. And then he said, think of how many people criticized the Buddha when he was alive. Yeah? And, you know, a lot of people criticized the Buddha. So if people are going to criticize the Buddha, they're certainly going to criticize me. Okay. So that was really helpful, you know, in passing that on. In case you're ever in that position, you can remember it. Okay, but back to the Sangha Karma. That was one tangent. Come back here. Okay, so the Sangha Karma is depending upon how many or what kind of action it is. You need a minimum number of people present for it to be a quorum. Yeah. Kind of like, you know, when the Jews pray as a group, you need 10 men. That's it. You know, otherwise it's kind of, it's not totally kosher. I mean, you can still pray, but it doesn't become, it's not a minyan, okay? So the same with the Sangha. So for, like I was saying, with ordination, it's 10 people in a central, 5 if it's in a decentral place. And so for different kinds of actions, you need different minimums. And then similarly, the way things are done is somebody will present the proposition and then ask 3 times, or not necessarily 3 times, sometimes just once, you know. So again, depending upon the action to be taken, you know, it will be announced once and then asked various number of times, okay? And so it was announced once and then, you know, kind of, you know, is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay? You know, and if you remain silent, then it was okay. So in order in the consensus to not go along, you were had to be the voice who said, no, it's not okay. So, yeah, so for any of these Sangha Karmas to be valid, like I said, you know, you needed to have the requisite number, okay? I have it written here. I can tell you what how many can do what. Okay, so so four people can perform all the acts except ordination, and the ceremony that's done to put you into Vasa, the rains retreat, so that's called Pavarama, that ceremony. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's Gaile. That's the after rains retreat. Okay, so, I'm sorry, I'm not explaining this very clearly. There's three things that a Sangha community needs to do to really function as a Sangha community and to consider the Dharma to flourish in the country. Okay? One is the posada, the confession ceremony. One is this rainy seasons retreat that starts on the full moon of the fourth lunar month, although the Tibetans do it on the full moon of the sixth lunar month. It goes for 3 months, or the Tibetans have a shorter version, it goes for 6 weeks. And then the third one is the ceremony at the end of the rains retreat. Because during the rains retreat, nobody criticizes each other, because you're living together and you want to keep harmony. Or not criticize, but nobody admonishes each other. But at the end of that ceremony, or at the end of the rainy seasons retreat, you invite admonishment. So you ask people, please give me feedback. I need feedback. Okay, so that ceremony. Okay, so also another one that four monks can't do is the Abana ceremony. So there's this very elaborate ceremony. In our categories of vows, we have the defeats, and if you break one of the defeats, you lose your ordination. You're out. Okay, so there's four for the men, you know, and eight for the women. If you break one of those, your ordination's finished. Then there's the next set down of precepts are called Sangavasesa, and those are called remainders. So if you break one of those, you still have a remainder of your ordination, but you have to go through this repentance thing where you sit at the end of the row and you serve the Sangha and you do all these other kinds of things, making yourself quite humble. Because you transgressed one of those vows. And to restore you after this penance period back into your regular status so that you would sit in your ordination order again and not have to do these other things, there has to be 20 people there. Okay? So for the monks there has to be 20 monks, for the nuns 20 monks, 20 nuns. And so it's, you know, so this I think is one of the ways in which they kept people from doing the Sangavasesa was because it was so embarrassing publicly and because it was so difficult to get reinstated because you had to have so many people there. So it made you much more mindful of breaking that level of precepts. Then there's another level of precepts where you have goods that you're not supposed to have, and those you go in front of the whole community and you give it back. You know, during sojourn, everybody's there and you say, I have too many begging bowls, or alms bowls, I have too many, robes, I got this food and I've been hoarding it and I'm not supposed to, and you give it back. And then you confess, and then what's curious is they then give the item back to you. Yeah. But you have to go through this thing of, admitting to the whole community that you had it when you shouldn't. And then there's another category, in all the rest of the categories of precepts, you go to an individual to confess. And then the very last category are more rules of etiquette, and those you just do your own personal confession. But you know what I've noticed in terms of the rules of etiquette? That these are often the ones that cause the most disharmony in a community. You know, because they're basic, just kind of basic things. It's like in a family, you know, many of you have heard me say before that so much conflict arises in a family because people don't use basic human manners. And the moment you start using basic human manners, relationships with people start changing. So just saying please, saying thank you. So the ones in this kind of group of, just etiquette are how you wear your robes, not being really sloppy, a lot of things like that, guidelines about how you walk, you know, how you stand, what kind of clothes you can wear, all different kinds of things like this. Yeah, a lot about how you eat. Yeah. And so just things of etiquette. And you can see how if people keep these, first of all, your behavior gets much more refined. So it's a great mindfulness practice. And second of all, if you don't keep them, then they're like very obvious stuff that other people are going to go, you know, so-and-so, their robes, you know, the way they wear their robes, they're always a mess. And so-and-so's, you know, licking their bowl. Of course, the Tibetans lick their bowl, but you're actually not supposed to lick your bowl. And in Tibetan culture, it was acceptable, you know. And it's very interesting, culture to culture. In Japanese culture, when you eat noodles, you're supposed to slurp. It shows you enjoy them. In Vinaya, you're not supposed to slurp when you eat. Okay? You know, in Indian culture, you can eat with your fingers. In American culture, if you eat with your fingers, people think you're very uncouth. Okay? Same in Chinese culture, where we have certain things that you can eat with your fingers, but other things that you're not supposed to eat with your fingers. But in India, eating with your fingers in that way is okay. But in India, you can only eat with your right hand, because with your left hand, they didn't have toilet paper, and they often still don't, is what you use to clean yourself after you go poo. And so you only eat with your right hand, you know. So, but, you know, we go into into India, we eat with our left hand, and then we're, you know. So, okay, but eating with your left hand is okay in America, but eating with your fingers isn't. Yeah? In India, it's just kind of the total opposite, isn't it? You know, and same with licking your bowl and stuff like that. Okay? So, I think some of those things we have to update according to our own culture. Okay? Because, and the purpose of those is so that people don't think, you know, oh, these people, they're so uncouth, you know. You know? And so, you know, yeah, all these different kinds of things. And you can see how it would be very easy for people living together to become very critical of other people, you know, if they didn't keep just basic etiquette. Yeah? Or, you know, somebody has, you know, your job is to, I don't know, you know, some minor task and you're always not doing it, you know, that's going to create disharmony. Or when you don't put things away where they belong, it creates disharmony. So all these small things are kind of, you know, matters of etiquette. And these are the kind of things I'd like to look at what Thich Nhat Hanh, how he rewrote things, because I bet you some of these things that aren't in there because it was written 2,500 years or 2,600 years ago, we would put in there because they're etiquette measures for us now. Yeah. So, but, you know, so this is this whole thing of, you know, just learning what the etiquette is in your society and kind of conforming to it. Anyway, back to the Sangha Karma. throwing in all these little details as we go along. Okay, so, you know, different numbers according to the different kind of action, and then also similarly different number of times that you ask if the community agrees according to the type of action it is. So this leads you with, well, you know, is the thing just decided right there, you know, that you're sitting in a room and you say, you know, so-and-so says, let's do this, and everybody, and they ask three times, and you have to make a snap judgment? No. You know, what often happens is that an issue is brought up. It isn't brought to this consensus kind of determination at the beginning, but it's discussed, and then you wait a while, and people discuss amongst themselves, and when you feel that kind of everybody's on board, then you have the meeting. And everybody agrees in consensus. Okay? So this is very different to how we do meetings. And I noticed, like, in Asia, if any of you have ever worked, you know, a long time in an Asian culture, you see meetings have a totally different thing. in Asia than here. You know, for us, we gather together in a meeting, we hash it all out, and we make a decision at the end. Okay? In Asia, you hash everything all out outside the meeting. Okay? And then you come together when everybody's on board. So it's a different kind of thing. When I lived in Missouri at the Chinese monastery, I couldn't figure out how decisions were made. Because we would have a meeting, we would decide things, and then those things were never upheld. And then other decisions were instituted instead. And it took me a long time to wake up that, duh, this was the way their culture did things. You know, and that I, you know, and the other Western monk, they were operating by our culture, which wasn't their culture. And so, of course, you know, we were a little bit befuddled how things happen. Okay. But I think that that's an interesting thing to, you know, to see, do you do things by vote? Do you do things by consensus? And how do you do things by consensus? Do you let one person who has a strong opinion hold everybody up? Or does everybody just try and think, if I could live with this, I'll consent, even if I don't think it's the number one preferable thing for me? Okay? And if you aren't a, you know, whenever there's a community meeting, a Sangha act, a Sangha Karma, everybody has to be there. So you can't use the thing of, oh, I wasn't at that meeting when you decided this, so I want to call it all back up for reexamination and I don't agree. You had to be there. And if you weren't able to be there, you had to tell somebody else, to tell the community that you couldn't come and that you would agree to whatever decision they made. Okay? So there was none of this filibustering, none of this, you know, you decided behind my back, I wasn't there, I didn't know you were going to do it. You know, you had to, before the meeting, you know, send word that you couldn't be there and that you would agree. Okay? And after a decision was made, whether it was a decision to do a certain project or a disciplinary thing or, you know, something, it couldn't be brought up again. And I think that this was very interesting because it's like, otherwise, you know, you bring it up, you make a decision. One person changes their mind. Then you have to spend more time and talk about it again. Then somebody else doesn't. And then meanwhile, you know, nothing ever gets done because everybody's being disputatious. So, you know, once the decision was made and you set word that, you know, you agreed and whatever, you went along with what everybody did. Yeah. Of course, later, you know, circumstances changed and people began to feel different. The whole community could change course. But there was none of this, you know, they really did their best to cut down on people being argumentative. Yeah. And I think, and this is also something that's kind of challenging for us because, you know, we so much want to be heard, don't we? And we want everybody to hear our opinion and we want our, you know, we push and push sometimes for things to be done a certain way. And we're also very opinionated. I mean, we were trained to have opinions. Even as young kids, I mean, you look, what do parents ask their kids? What is your favorite color? Do you want orange juice or apple juice? Do you want to go play with Billy or with Susan? I mean, from the time we're very young, we're asked to make decisions and to have opinions. In Asia, when you grew up, nobody cared what your favorite color was. Your parents just kind of, you know, told you what to do and you did it and you were happy doing it. And you didn't construct an opinion factory at age 3 that worked overtime like mine does, you know? And I think in some ways it just makes life easier. Like when we had the Vajrasattva retreat in Canada, you know, that was in 98. We had the Vajrasattva retreat in Canada. So there was somebody from Singapore there, and there were 1, 2, 3, 4 Mexicans there. And I was doing my own personal retreat, so I wasn't in on these meetings. But the Singaporeans and Mexicans were very baffled. Why are they having a vote about how much milk we drink each week? You know, and why are they having a vote about whether the kitchen gets one thing of yogurt or two things of yogurt? And why are they having a vote about whether lights out is at 9:30 or 9:45? I mean, they were totally baffled about the amount of time that was taken to discuss these very ordinary things. Because in their culture, they said, look, one person makes the decision and everybody follows it. And they said, it's much more efficient that way. You don't spend so much time. And they were just scratching their heads at the Americans, you know. So I think this is quite an interesting thing. And also for us to look at personally how we really push sometimes to have our voice heard and to make things exactly as we wanted, you know. And, you know, and so there's sometimes where there may be a very good reason behind it, okay? Like Nancy this morning when she said, please freeze the applesauce, there was a very good reason behind it because we need it in the winter and now we don't need it, you know? But then there's other times when it's like we want to choreograph everything so it meets all of our personal preferences, yeah? And so that's a very interesting thing for us to look at when, you know, when is it that there's a good reason behind something and when is it that it's just preference? And when is it that we just want to make sure everybody knows that I'm here? Yeah? And that, and this could very easily relate to our discussion about authority yesterday too. You know? And how, you know, somebody was saying like, you know, and I heard it too, you know, this is not a democracy. And I remember as a kid thinking, well, why not? But actually, you know, a family with young children should not be a democracy. It shouldn't be. You know, and I watch that because I travel in and stay in people's homes. Children run the family. Mm-hmm. Parents ask their children permission about what to do. I mean, my generation is completely messed up, you know, because the parents want their children to approve of them so badly, you know, that they ask their kids, you know, oh, can we do this? Shall we go here? You know, Johnny, you know, let's go in the car now. Is that okay with you? It just astounds me because I was never spoken to that way as a kid. And actually, I don't think I should have been. You know, I mean, when you're a kid, when you're new, you don't have the wisdom to make those decisions. Okay? So it's kind of, you know, similar sometimes when we come in community life. And I think that's why the people who are not fully ordained do not make major decisions about things. They may have a voice, and I think it's very interesting. Catholic churches is, you know, functions very similarly in that they have, you know, one, so often it's up to just the abbot or abbess, but they may have an inner circle. But everybody gets to make suggestions, and Saint Benedict says that sometimes the youngest ones have the best ideas because they're very fresh. So everybody offers suggestions, but in a monastery, Catholic monastery, just a few people make the decision. In a Buddhist sense, everybody offers suggestions, but you know the fully ordained ones make the decision, and it should be that way. You know, I mean, in a family, except sometimes even as a kid, you don't even have a reasonable suggestion to ask. I mean, let's eat candy 3 meals a day is not a reasonable suggestion. Okay. So, and I saw, you know, when I first lived in Dorje Thoma Monastery, then we didn't have any, you know, none of us were fully ordained then, but some of us were senior to others. And you would get people who were freshly ordained, and they would come in, and they're coming in on the Western voting model, thinking, you know, I'm freshly ordained, I have the equal vote to people who've been ordained a long time. They had no clue what monastic life was about. No clue. When you first ordained, you have no clue. You haven't been trained. That's why you get trained. And yet these people expected their opinions to be listened to, although they had no clue what, you know, precepts were, how monastery functions, anything like that. Okay, so sometimes, I mean, there's definite reasons for these kinds of things. You know, and similarly, you know, when you work together, on a crew, you know, if you're working together, you know, building, you follow the leadership of the person who's doing the building. You offer suggestions, but at the end, that person has more expertise, or in the kitchen, you know, you follow the, you know, you can offer suggestions, but ultimately, you know, that person kind of has to make the decision on how it's going to go. And so I think that's a big thing for us in entering community life, is learning to be okay when it's not our way. Yeah? And just to observe how much, you know, we do not like that. And, you know, where's that coming from? That it always has to go the way I want it to. You know, how much is there that little two-year-old, you know, going, ah! You know? It's not the way I want it to be. Ah! I'm going to make it miserable for everybody else. Yeah? And so sometimes, you know, that person makes it miserable just by being uncooperative. Sometimes they make it miserable by doing all sorts of other things where it looks like they didn't do some, you know, the whole passive-aggressive thing, and sometimes, you know, they make it miserable, they don't show up, and, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of things, but it's a very interesting way to look at our own mind, isn't it? Yeah. So, I mean, this is all, the whole thing involved in community life and how the Sangha functions. Okay, so, tomorrow we're going to talk more about the history. I'm not going to go over time today, so I learned my lesson. What happened about that? Okay, so you know, gradually we'll get this. But I think these things, you know, a lot of these things we're talking about. I mean, this is basic common instruction. If you're, that's really important. And it talks. What I'm doing is trying to show how living in community and keeping the precepts is not just a legalistic thing, you know, because some people say the precepts was one of the first legal codes. And in a way, it is a legal code for the operation of the Sangha. But it's not just a legalistic thing, you know. And living in a community isn't just a thing of, you know, wherever you happen to live and, you know, what can the community do for me. But that all of these things, you know, relate very specifically to our Dharma practice and give us an incredible field in which, an environment in which to observe what's going on in our mind. Yeah? Don't they? Yeah? And you see that living here. And I think it's important just to remember we're all going through the same experience and, you know, and watching our minds and working with our minds and trying to be, we're trying to, you know, work with our own minds, and we're also trying to have some compassion for ourselves, and we have different days when we do better and different days when we don't do so good, and, you know, that kind of, you know, all of this is stuff that we use for practice. Yeah? And so that our daily life and our Dharma practice are very much interwoven. Yeah, it isn't that you go, you know, you do whatever you want during the day and then you come in here and you sit and of course your mind is single-pointed. That's not going to work because if you're doing whatever you want during the day, your mind could be, you know, bonkers by the time you get in here. It's going to be, you know, hard to work with. And so what goes on in our mind during the day when we come here, you know, we can use, you know, if we're angry or, you know, who knows what's going on, or attached or jealous or spaced out or whatever it is, we use our meditation session to really look more in depth with what's ever going on. And then we use our life together as community for the proof of the pudding, for the field to develop in. Questions? Comments?
Uh-huh. So do you have a vision for maybe changing that a little bit about, you know, not having to
compassion? Yeah, I think, you know, so it's good. What, like many of the Western communities have done, at Gumpo Abbey, Thich Nhat Hanh's people, you know, Anuravati is they have Sangha meetings either on the day that, of Posada or on the previous day, and people kind of discuss and just go around in a circle. And so often, rather than say it to one person, they may say it to the entire community. And often, or some of them may just say it to one person, but if it's something that affects the whole community, it often comes out in those discussions. Or if there's any other thing that's been going on in the community where there's, you know, you can feel some energy going on or somebody has something that they need to work out with somebody else, those things also come up in those community meetings. And like Thich Nhat Hanh's people have a very specific way of doing it, which I think is very nice. And the first time you go around, everybody apologizes for what they feel they need to apologize for. So apology is kind of like confession, you know. I mean, you say what you need to say. And then the second time you go around, if you have something that you noticed about somebody else that you need to give them some feedback on, you give them that feedback. But before you do so, you also say something nice about the person, you know. And it's, you know, feedback or admonishment is seen as part of living together in a community. It's not seen as criticism. And this is another thing that we have to get over, you know, because we think anytime somebody gives us negative feedback, it's criticism. It's not criticism, you know. What we have to do, of course, is to learn how to give feedback in a compassionate way. But when you're living together in a community, feedback is given out of care and love because we're all trying to help each other grow. So the object isn't to put somebody down and humiliate them and, you know, vent all your anger on them. The thing is to really express, you know, what you see that may help them. Yeah. And then, of course, it's an opportunity for that person to be a little bit transparent and say, yeah, I have this problem. And, you know, thank you for bringing it to my attention. Or it's going to be, I know about this problem and it's a really big one for me. And so I request your patience. But whenever I do it, please remind me again because I space out sometimes. Yeah. And so, you know, having that kind of forum whereby these things can be expressed. And times just also where you take care of, you know, any other conflict that may be going on that has nothing to do with confession, or sometimes you may want to give somebody good feedback and say, you know, I know I can see you're really working with X, Y, and Z. Yeah, so it's a time to give somebody good feedback too. Or it's a time to just say, look, I'm having, you know, a real problem with this. And so people, please, you know, help me. Yeah, because we, you know, what's our usual lay way of things, you know, either I love you and I tell you I love you to bits, or I criticize you and tear you down. You know, we don't know how to give admonishment and receive admonishment, but it's very, very important. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, people give us admonishment and, yeah. I do that. Doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean I'm evil. It doesn't mean I'm hopeless. It doesn't mean that person's mad at me. It doesn't mean they don't trust me. It doesn't mean they hate me. Yeah. It's just feedback. But we are like so attached to our reputation, aren't we? And so attached to praise. I mean, talk about being sensitive. So, you know, it becomes then very difficult to, you know, it becomes very difficult on everybody because a person who's very sensitive, it's like, you know, they're ready to explode. And then everybody else feels like they have to tiptoe around that person so that they don't explode. And so then it becomes really dysfunctional because the things that need to get talked about don't get talked about because you're trying to keep, you know, that person is essentially holding the whole community in hostage. Their anger holds the community in hostage because things don't get discussed. They need to get discussed. Yeah. So, Anyway, it's live and learn, isn't it? Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, I've seen it in myself, like sometimes, look at, you know, now looking back on something, I'll go, wow, I got so offended and insulted and hurt by da-da-da-da-da that happened. Whenever it happened, like, looking back on it now, it's like there was nothing there. What was going on in me that I was so hurt by that? You know, I don't know if it's happened to any of you. You know? Never? Oh, you just are sure that it's always the other person. Oh, I know that. But sometimes, I mean, really looking back, wow, why was I so sensitive? That made no sense. Yeah. And so sometimes, you know, years later, going back to a person and saying to them, you know, I'm really sorry for the way I acted when you said this and such to me. You know, I have no idea what was going on in me then. Okay, last question.